Hey everyone, welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm extremely excited to be joined by Dr. Jeremy Lenicky. He's one of really the leading researchers in blood flow restriction. Really glad that he took the time out of the day to come on the podcast. Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, I'm really excited in terms of this conversation. Got a bunch of questions. One of them is from Chris Bradner over at Aspire Academy, and he's extremely excited. He's wanted to talk to you for a long time, and he said, finally feel like I'm getting the chance to talk to him via these questions.
Nice.
So before we get to the questions, I was just hoping that you could give the listeners a bit of a background about yourself.
Academically, I did my undergrad in exercise science. I did my master's in nutrition. Both of those were done at Southeast Missouri State University. I went to Illinois for a little bit, did an internship up there in a muscle phys lab. That's really where I really learned how to do science. And then I went to the University of Oklahoma for my PhD. And I've done blood flow restriction work all through my master's and my PhD. And now I'm an assistant professor at the University of Mississippi. So we're continuing to work on blood flow restriction, et cetera. I know a lot of your listeners are a lot of soccer fans or people in soccer. I'm not a soccer fan, but just didn't grow up with it. So I don't know a whole lot about that. But blood flow restriction, I can answer a few questions about that, I'm sure.
No, that's essentially why I brought you on, just to talk about blood flow restriction. So no worries about that. I actually have a quick follow-up question. What made you interested to research blood flow restriction?
Yeah, so I'm sure some of your listeners may know or at least heard of Lane Norton.
Yep.
but when I was up in Illinois, it was just right after my undergrad, I was actually in my undergrad finishing it up. And I was up there interning at the University of Illinois with Dr. Huey. Gold Champagne, which was at the time pretty much like the mecca of bodybuilding, of natural bodybuilding, at least in the Midwest. So that's where I kind of ran. I had known Lane for probably quite a few years online, but we, you know, all trained at the same place. And I saw him kind of doing some of this in the gym. And we got to talking about it. And I, of course, thought it was crazy. I had actually read a paper about it as an undergrad, but I didn't really. You know, you're an undergrad, you know, you don't know what you're reading. So yeah. I just thought I read it wrong. I'm like, how could you possibly restrict blood flow and something good happen? I go, I must not know what I'm reading. But then I was talking to him about it and I just started reading. And it just kind of progressed into me studying the practical model, blood flow restriction using knee wraps. And I went to Oklahoma, worked with Dr. Mike Benben, Dr. Takashi Abe, who I still work with today, Dr. Abe. He's done a tremendous amount of work in that. But it really centered around reading a couple papers and seeing, you know, Lane and talking with him in the gym. This is probably back in 2007, so quite a while ago.
Yeah, and it looks like it just continued and something that you ended up falling in love with.
Yeah, definitely.
So to transition now, I actually want to start asking some of the questions. The first one that I have, and this one's from Chris Bradner, is: what are your thoughts on the true mechanisms behind muscle growth with blood flow restriction? There are some theoretical models that have been put out regarding cell swelling. How do we test for this? And what do we know for sure that is causing the stimulus for muscle growth with blood flow restriction?
Well, that's quite a question, Chris. And he knows it's quite a question. Yeah. The mechanisms behind blood flow restriction and how it works. I think cell swelling, I do think that there's some that may be playing somewhat of a role, but by just having cell swelling by itself is probably not doing a whole lot. I think you obviously have to be activating the muscle locally. So I do think it's, you know, you have local mechanotransduction, and how that happens or how that works, I don't think anybody knows. I don't think there's many people who know how that works with traditional resistance training either. But, you know, in general, the kind of the thing that we talk about with resistance training is, you know, there's some cell swelling that might be important. as long as there's other things that are happening. For example, maybe this metabolic accumulation, I still think that's having some type of an important role, especially with, you know, not necessarily with, you know, traditional exercise, but definitely when you're using lower loads, I think it might be playing a role where we're pulling these metabolites. I think there's something very special about restricting blood flow and keeping fluid in that and those metabolites around the muscle, you know, during exercise, during the rest periods. I think that might be important. So I think the cell swelling in combination with metabolic accumulation in combination with the augmented fiber type recruitment, I think all of those are playing a role in leading to this hypertrophic signaling, et cetera. So that's how I answer his question without really answering his question. So, you know, the cell swelling thing, I think might be important, but I don't think it's nearly as important as I once thought it was. So I don't think just having cell swelling is enough for growth, at least meaningful growth.
Yeah. And he actually has a second question. So he said that one of your original papers in 2010, 2011 looked at a meta-analysis of studies and strength didn't change until the 10-week time point.
Yeah.
He said this led them to conclude that neural adaptations may have occurred until late in training, and early adaptations are mainly dominated at the muscular level. He said, while an opposite model proposed in 1988 showed that neuroadaptations are responsible for strength initially. So his question was, do you still believe that neuroadaptations come second for blood flow restriction compared to changes at the muscular level?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, to talk about the meta-analysis real quick, you know, you have to understand that it's really dependent upon what studies that you actually include in that analysis. And sometimes you can get some weird things that come out, right? So that meta-analysis suggests that strength changes, you know, don't change until 10 weeks. That's obviously nonsense, because we've done short-term studies in 3 or 4 weeks and seen strength changes, you know, but it all depends on, you know, that meta-analysis included walking studies, included a lot of things. So, and all of those studies depend on what time points those things were measured. As far as the strength, the hypertrophy versus neural, you know, driving the muscle strength gain, my thoughts on this have kind of go back and forth on it, basically on a daily basis. You know, if you look at the literature, how they go about deciding whether or not neural changes are happening is they'll look at the muscle size relative to the strength change, right? And then they'll say, well, it basically the ratio didn't change, so all the strength came from lifting, or all the strength change that happened came from muscle growth. Now, one of the guys who got me thinking about this a lot, this was probably 3 or 4 years ago, was Stu Phillips, thinking about, you know, specificity of the test and things like that. So, for example, if you look at a lot of the blood flow restriction literature, you know, if you have one group that's training specifically with high loads, right, and you have another group that's specifically training with low loads and blood flow restriction, and you test them on the lift that both of them are using, the high load is going to win almost every single time, you know, because it's specific, right? Yep. So if you give a test that neither one of them have practiced, typically the strength is the same, like on an isokinetic dynamometer, the testing is usually the same. Not always, but typically. So I think it's very hard to know what neural changes are happening and when is strength change happening, because I don't think that we ever give really a, I don't really ever feel like we have a fair test to really test that, because yep. You're asking a group that's trained with 30% of their max and at lift to all of a sudden train at 100% of their max, compared to a group that's been training at 70-80% of their max. You know, who do you think would perform better in that? Right? It doesn't necessarily mean that neither group's got stronger, right? It's just that, you know, one's been practicing the test a lot longer than the other. I'm under the impression, and I know I'm kind of beating around the bush with this answer, but I'm really under the impression that strength testing is not very objective at all. I think it's probably the most subjective measurement there is. Muscle size, I think, is pretty objective, right? Yeah. Either it's getting bigger or it's not. It's not really specific to anything other than the training stimulus. But strength testing is quite subjective based on what that person's been doing, right? So I think if you look overall at the response, if you have low loads compared to high loads, both groups always increase strength. You know, the high load group is usually going to increase the strength a little bit more in the exercise that they were doing, as you would expect with specificity. But in overall strength, I basically think the response is pretty similar.
Yeah, and I actually want to switch over to something that is maybe slightly more practical to some of the strength conditioning guys out there that are listening to this. And it's really, I know there's been a ton of studies done on blood flow restriction training in elite athletes. Kind of my question is, there's been studies looking at both concentric and eccentric. Which one do you feel would be better in a performance setting? And also, how do you feel that blood flow restriction can be applied in like an elite athlete setting?
Yeah, well, I think we've looked at the different muscle actions before, and it seems like the concentric actions is really maybe driving most of the response. There's not a lot going on in the eccentric portion of lift. I mean, if you think about it, you're working out at 20 to 30% of your max.
Yeah.
So the eccentric portion is going to be even less than that. You know, where it might be useful, maybe during injury or maybe during a time where, you know, I talk about this a lot, is where there's days where you go to the gym where you psychologically don't have it, right? So it might make sense to train with lower weights that don't require a lot of focus, right? You know, training with the heavy weight, I mean, if you're not in the zone that day, you could get hurt. Whereas, you know, I mean, you could get hurt with low weight, but it's highly unlikely, right?
Yeah, it definitely reduces the chances.
Yeah, if you, I mean, one could ask the question about how much muscle gain could a lot of these athletes get. That's a fair point. I would argue that most of them probably not going to get a whole lot more. But if we look at the time course of muscle growth between blood flow restriction and high load training, just looking at, you know, just based on some of the work that we've done, just separately in separate studies, I really think the time course of muscle growth is much faster with blood flow restriction. I think the muscle increases size much faster than high load training. And we've done some studies recently that lead me to, you know, further believe that. So how that applies to an athlete, I really don't know, because you could argue that, you know, they're not gaining much, you know, a whole lot more muscle mass probably. But I think for an athlete, I think you could use it to increase training frequency, because if for whatever reason you needed to increase frequency, and but you didn't want to add a whole lot more overall stress to the body, as in like high, low mechanical stress, it might make sense to replace one of those days with blood flow restriction. That way you can get, you know, maybe some added volume, some added work without a lot of the damage response that occurs with normal training. So that's, you know, one way that it could be utilized. But, you know, one of the things I always say is, you know, you don't have to. And I think that's an important point that people miss. People always go, well, you know, I like training the way I train, you know, I don't see, well, then don't use it. It doesn't make me any difference at all, right? But there's certain aspects where it could be beneficial, you know, like increasing frequency if you're hurt, you know, replacing, you know, if you're hurt and you can't train with heavy loads, it makes sense to at least maintain something, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's, for an athlete, I would say increasing frequency or just the injury, you know, if they're injured, you know, just getting some work in that way. Or rehabilitation, et cetera.
Yeah, because I know in terms of the rehab setting, especially for the physiotherapists that are listening out there, a joint has been completely immobilized. Blood flow restriction has been shown that it can help reduce kind of what's occurring in terms of muscle atrophy.
Yeah. There's a couple studies that show that, you know, there's a couple published studies that show that. There's one that doesn't really support that. So overall, I would say there might be something positive with that. It might be something to try. But there's not a tremendous amount of evidence behind that. There's some. I mean, those papers exist, right? There are papers that exist that show post-ACL surgery, applying blood flow restriction attenuates that loss. They do exist, but the if you were to compare the evidence for that versus the evidence of low loads in combination with blood flow restriction with resistance training, it's not even close. There's no question that blood flow restriction in combination with low loads with resistance training works. No question, right? But applying blood flow restriction in the absence of muscle contraction, there is some, but I would, you know, I wouldn't bet my whole house on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. And actually, I do want to transition to a question, since we're on the topic of light loads versus heavy loads. So question that I have is, many studies show that light loads plus blood flow restriction induces similar gains to heavy training without blood flow restriction. However, there are also studies that show that it doesn't. So what are your thoughts on this for healthy populations versus clinical populations?
Yeah, there's a whole host of things. I would say anytime you look at literature, you have to look at the totality of the literature. So most studies, do show hypertrophy comparable to high load training, right? There are some studies, but a lot of that, you have to look at the methodology behind that. We're big proponents of making the pressure relative to the person, right? Instead of just applying the same pressure to everyone. There's big problems in the literature with how people are applying pressure, in my opinion. So I think that's a big thing to consider. But it's something that I always hear. So this is, blood flow restriction is only applicable to clinical people. And I don't agree with that, because almost every study we've ever done is not even in clinical people. Other people have done that research. One of my collaborators, Johnny Owens, he's at the Center for the Intrepid. He's been on ESPN. He uses it with these rehabbing soldiers. He uses it with rehabbing NFL players, American football players, etc. But we've shown this. We've shown that muscle growth increases in untrained people, and trained people, and old people, and young people. We've shown it in about everyone. So I would just say, look at the totality of literature, and it's pretty convincing. At least to me. I would say that the studies that show a benefit far outweigh any studies that show a null effect.
No, definitely. And I'm glad that you actually mentioned Johnny Owens, because I think he's doing some fantastic work with veterans that are coming back. And I believe you're doing a seminar with him at the ACSM in June or July.
Yeah, at the beginning of June, we're giving a tutorial lecture up in Boston at the ACSM conference. So, when the proposals kind of got sent out, I kind of contacted him, because we've been kind of collaborating back and forth. I've served kind of a scientific advisor for him and Center for the Intrepid for a couple of years. And I agree, he's doing some tremendous work. So I kind of reached out to him. I was like, man, we should propose and see if we can get, kind of get this accepted and kind of get it out there. So I think, I can't remember the exact title, but it's kind of like talking about science and applying it to military heroes and sports idols or something like that. So really how it's going to be set up is, I'm going to spend the first half of it talking about the science behind blood flow restriction, how we think it might be working, et cetera, how to, set the pressure relative to the person, and how we think best to set the pressure. Then he's going to come in and talk about all the clinical results that he has. And he's been seeing some great things, especially, hearing him talk about the veterans is cool, because a lot of these guys, they come back. Some of his early work was in blast trauma soldiers. He was telling me this, how much the soldiers just really loved it, because for the first time in a long time, they actually felt like they were working out. Like they felt like they had a good workout, because they're so limited in what they can actually do. So it's been pretty interesting to see that to move into these clinics, right, and to actually be utilized. I think that's great.
One thing that you mentioned is kind of individualizing the pressures for blood flow restriction. And obviously, in a clinical setting, this is easier. But when you're talking about just using knee wraps in order to do it, how do you go about figuring out the right pressure? Because obviously, you're just trying to occlude the muscle for a short period of time, but it's still, there's some danger involved.
Right. So I always make a clear distinction between practical blood flow restriction, so average people like us in the gym. So, and differentiate that between what we do in research and in clinics, right? So at the muscle level, so, maybe this isn't true for vascular adaptations, et cetera. I'm not sure. But if we look at just muscle growth and muscle adaptation, we have data that suggests that if you apply a very low pressure, meaning 40% of the pressure that it takes to cut off blood flow completely, if you compare that to 90% arterial occlusion, meaning you're 10% take to cut blood flow off completely at rest. So when we compare those two stimulus, muscle adaptation is the same, despite differences in exercise volume, right?
Okay.
So that tells me that there's some range where you can apply this pressure and muscle adaptation is the same. Obviously, at the higher pressure, you have higher perceptual responses, et cetera, right? So when we did that study, we didn't see any negative effects at 90%. But if you're using your brain, if there's going to be something negative happen, it's probably going to be at the higher pressure.
Yeah.
Right. So how does that relate to people who are using knee wraps? Well, what it tells me is, one, it's a good thing because we know that we have some type of range, right?
Yeah.
It's a decent range. But what it tells us is that you don't have to be super tight when you apply it. You just need moderate restriction. If you apply about half of the pressure that it takes to cut off blood flow completely, right, you're going to be fine, right? And I would argue that, most people aren't, going to get at arterial occlusion when they wrap. So most people in the gym would be fine. But in a clinic, it's very, very, very important to know what pressure you're applying, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're applying it to veterans, people who are in the military, right? If you hurt one of those guys, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
Right? So, anyone, but in the research setting, we need to know the pressure, right? I've done practical blood flow restriction and published that. We didn't know the pressure, but you have a pretty good idea that it's not cutting off blood flow, right? So there's obvious limitations with that. But so I always differentiate. So people who are just applying this in the gym, healthy people in the gym, do they need to know the pressure? Probably it's not that big of a, it's not that big of a deal. They're able-bodied, et cetera, right? As long as they're not cutting it off completely.
Yeah, as long as you're not being stupid about it.
Yeah, as long as they're not cutting off completely, they're probably going to be in that range, and they're probably going to have the same adaptation, right? But in a clinical setting, right, it's very important. And that's where we talk about individualizing the pressures all the time. Our lab's research has been focusing on this for probably 6 years, right, where it's like, if you look through the literature on blood flow restriction, and we just had a paper come out yesterday on this same topic, the pressure has to be set relative to the cuff, and it has to be set relative to the person. Otherwise, it's a different stimulus. So people are going to go, well, you just said in practical blood flow restriction, it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Well, the reason why it matters in research is because we're trying to compare things. So we need to make sure that the stimulus is the same, right? We're not doing personal training. We're doing science, right? We need to know what the hell's going on. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you look through the literature, I just saw a paper come out again today. And it's like they just randomly apply a cuff and they randomly apply a pressure. So with no thought behind it whatsoever. And I think it's a big problem. And we've been saying it's potentially a big problem for about 6 years. And we've shown data time and time and time again that show if you apply the same pressure from one cuff to another cuff, it's a completely different stimulus, right? And maybe, at the muscle level, the adaptation would be the same, but the risk factor, the risk of something negative happening would be much greater. We've shown that. We've shown that if you apply the same cuff, if you apply the same pressure to a narrow cuff and a wide cuff, the cardiovascular response is quite different. The cardiovascular response meaning blood pressure at the heart, blood pressure at the brachial artery, it's all different. It's augmented, right? So the cardiovascular response is much greater. Now, for a healthy person, that's probably not a big deal, right?
Yeah.
But for a clinical person, it could be.
Yeah, it could be a very big deal.
Right? So it's. I don't understand how people aren't grasping onto this individualization of pressure. I don't get it because let's talk about, lifting weights, for example. What if I told you, what if I had this scenario and said, I would just describe to you a study where I had everyone come in and they all lifted the same amount of weight. Some people were very strong, some people were very weak. Despite that, we just had them lift the same weight all of them for 12 weeks. You would laugh me out of the room. You would be like, what are you talking about? Some people are going to require more weight than the other. It's the same thing with pressure, right? Yeah. Bigger arms, bigger limbs require greater pressures. So, and we've shown this probably 600 times. So I don't know what else to say on the topic. I mean, we talk about it every single year. And every single year, people are like, yeah, that's a really good idea. And they never do anything about it. Right? So it's fascinating to me because it's a big deal, because if we ever want to get this moved really into the clinics for sure, we have to be applying pressures relative to the individual. And that's what Johnny Owens is doing. You know, so, you know, kudos to him for paying attention.
In the podcast with Chris that I just published actually yesterday, we talked a little bit about the history of blood flow restriction, and he kind of mentioned KAATSU and then how it ended up becoming blood flow restriction to try to, because KAATSU is actually a company. But I have seen, at least here in the United States, that there's these KAATSU accreditation programs or like certifications. Do you feel that there's any real need for that from a practitioner standpoint? If you're just like working with healthy individuals, whether it's athletes or just like your general population, to get an accreditation like that?
No, I mean, I should be careful saying this, but you know, if you want to use the KAATSU device, then yes, it's very important to do that, because there's a lot of things that are specific to the KAATSU device that aren't related to anything else, right? So there are some, you know, the KAATSU device is different, you know, but when we compare it to other devices, it seems to be exactly the same, right? As long as you make the pressure relative to the person, right? So, you know, I would say if you want to use the KAATSU, then yes, you should go and do what the KAATSU people want you to do. And I'll also say, some people would say that only the KAATSU can show positive muscle adaptation, et cetera, that these other ones aren't designed for blood flow restriction. It's true that the other devices that we use as well aren't designed for blood flow restriction like the KAATSU was, right? We use stuff that's designed to measure blood flow, right? But in using that, our lab and many, many, many other labs have shown positive beneficial adaptations. Right, the same ones seen with the KAATSU. So I would say, if you want to use the KAATSU, you should go through that. That device, that these results aren't specific to that device.
One of the questions that I asked Chris, and I think it's a good question to ask you as well, is, so right now there's tons of research going on in terms of blood flow restriction. I mean, there's literally papers coming out almost every single week. Where are the gaps? Like, what needs to be filled in? And from your standpoint, you know, what needs to be filled in the near future in order for us to get a even better understanding of blood flow restriction?
You know, I'm interested, you know, one of the things that, you know, we're looking at now is, you know, what is kind of this, I hate the word optimal, but what is the pressure that we can use to really maximize the whole response and lower the risk of something negative to happen? That's really what we're looking at. To be honest with you, it's really hard to compare a lot of blood flow restriction studies because, you know, they apply this random cuff sizes and they apply the same pressure to everyone. So it's really, to be honest with you, difficult to really always know what stimulus is actually being given, right? But overall, I think, you know, looking at what pressures are going to optimize the entire response, meaning positive muscle adaptation, safety, as well as vascular adaptations. And that's really what we're looking at. We're always centered around producing the greatest response as safe as we possibly can, right? That's always what we're looking at. Other than that, I think really, you know, and Johnny Owens and some other people are doing this work, really starting to apply it in the clinical settings. So we talk about using it in the clinical settings a lot, but we haven't done it a whole lot, right? The literature needs to be moving in that direction, in my mind. Also, I think mechanistically, we need to get an animal model, and I don't know how to do it, but to really study these mechanisms, we need an animal model. And we need an animal model that actually produces a stimulus that is what's given in the human condition, right? So there was a blood flow restriction study done in an animal model recently, But I would argue that the stimulus isn't even remotely close to what's done with blood flow restricted exercise in humans, right? So we need to be able to know what, you know, pressure we're applying. Is it partial restriction? Is it acute versus, you know, just a cutting it off completely for long periods of time? That's not what we do with humans, right? And we need to do low loads, right? Not high load, max eccentric contraction. That's not what we do in humans, right? So I think getting some type of animal model would be huge. And, you know, not that you can't study mechanisms in humans, but I feel like we could do a lot more in an animal model if someone could figure out how to do it. And I'm not, you know, it's easy for me to say, yeah, we need an animal model, but, you know, people would come and say, well, how would you do that? I don't know, right? It's difficult because with the pressure thing, it's another animal, you know, pun intended. But so that's another avenue. You know, I think the sporting thing is interesting, you know, maybe applying it more in that scenario. But I think if you're talking about where does it have the biggest implications, I don't think it's any question that it's in rehab and clinical settings, and maybe rehabbing athletes, perhaps, you know. But, you know, our research is focused on still, you know, finding this pressure that maximizes the whole stimulus, right, while minimizing the danger, right? I see a lot of times online, I try to never talk about it with blanket statements. But I see people say, you know, online, when people are going to, you know, people say a lot of dumb things about blood flow restriction, there's no question. But then people who come to the defense will say, you know, blood flow restriction is safe, you're an idiot, you know, there's no danger. Well, I wouldn't say that, definitely. Right? I mean, all training has some danger with it. When you're restricting blood flow, I mean, you're adding to that a little bit. There's no question that it's safe if done appropriately, right? But like anything else, it has to be done correctly. So, you know, that's really what we're looking at.
No, definitely. I mean, it's almost the same thing as lifting. I mean, there's inherent risk in lifting. If you do it correctly, exactly. That lift is, I mean, that is very minimal. But I mean, you're never going to say, hey, there's no danger involved when I'm putting 400 pounds to back squat.
Right. Absolutely.
The way I usually like to end most of my podcasts, and this is going to be a little bit different, but if anyone is actually interested in pursuing research, like let's say they have an exercise physiology or exercise science background, just graduating now with their undergrad degree, you know, what would be some recommendations that you would have for them?
Yeah, you know, I would look and see who's doing the, you know, what blood flow restriction groups. There's not a whole lot of us. There's a few of us in the United States, and there's some people over in Scandinavia and Japan, etc., that do blood flow restriction. So I would look at those and look at what universities they're at, you know, and read their work and see if that's something you're interested in, and then reach out to them, right? So it's one of those things where, you know, it's just because you want to go do a PhD, you know, you have to ask yourself, do you really want to do a PhD? Or are you just interested in this, you know, in this one topic, you know? But, you know, if my lab right now, my students are amazing. I have a full roster, right? You know, I have 4 PhD students, 2 master's students, and a postdoc with Gilberto Laurentino. So he's done some blood flow restriction work as well. He's from Brazil. He's working with our lab right now. So if anyone in the future, you know, is interested in working with us, you know, the thing that I always tell people, I get emails about this, people want to come and they're interested in working with us, which is awesome. One, you have to make sure, you know, just because someone says no, doesn't mean that they don't like you or they don't think you're good. You know, sometimes you have to have an opening, right? There's only so many students you can fund, right? So that's something you can, they can reach out and say, you know, I'm interested in your work. I'm interested in this, you know, are you going to be taking students? Do you have funding for students? Yep. Right. And the other thing is for me, you know, we're very team oriented in our lab. So if you could be very, very good, but if you're not going to fit into the team, then you're not coming to our lab. Yep. You know what I'm saying? So, and generally that's not ever a problem. Generally, it's just that I can't fund students, or I can't take any more students on, you know, or maybe that's the case somewhere else. But I would encourage them to see, you know, not even with blood flow restriction, just research in general, if that's something you want to do, look and see who's doing that research, right? Are they active? You know, that's one thing that I think is also a problem. Sometimes, you know, you'll send someone a letter and go, man, I really like, you know, or you'll look at their online portfolio and they'll talk about their research interests and you'll go, my research interests really line up with yours, but that person hasn't published in 10 years, right? You're going to be very disappointed. So I would look and see, you know, who's doing the research that you're interested in reading? And can you do, is this something that's going to keep you interested for a long period of time?
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, going to a PhD program, you know, master's is a little bit different. You know, if you want to start a PhD, I think you really need to ask yourself, why do I want to get this PhD? If it's because, if it's just so some people can call me doctor, that's a terrible reason. You're not going to make it at any legitimate program. You know what I'm saying? So why do you want to do this? Are you curious and want to know more? That's a good reason, right? Just to call you doctor. There's some people out there, and I know you know who they yeah. are, right? And the industry is full of them, right? Then that's a problem, right? So I would say that. And I would say make sure that you get to a program that has funding for you. Right. If you want to do science, you have to be there collecting data. If you want to do a PhD, you have to be there collecting data. Right. It's not reading papers. It's collecting data. That's what a PhD is. So if you're not in a situation where you can actually do research, then you're not doing a PhD. I don't know what you're doing, but it's not a PhD. You're reading yeah. other people's work. That's what you're.
So Jeremy, just, if anyone has any questions or comments and they want to reach out to you, you know, what's the best way I think can contact you?
The best way is probably Twitter, okay. to be honest with you, at JPLOENNEKE. Some people, I'm trying to say this as nice as possible. I get a lot of private Facebook messages every day. I don't respond to those anymore. I just can't, because there's just so many of them. And like my job is at a university, not to answer everyone's individual questions, because usually it's stuff that I've talked about before, or it's just like so in depth that I don't, you know, we don't know the answer, and that's not good enough for yeah. me typically. Right. They just keep following up, and it's nothing against them. They're curious. That's great. I don't have the time to answer every individual Facebook message. But if they hit me up on Twitter, it's better, because usually I've answered it, or I only have to answer it once, and then it answers other people's questions. Or maybe I don't know that somebody else can answer it. I don't know everything. There's quite a bit of stuff I don't know, but you know, maybe I can respond back with, I'm not sure. What about this person? Maybe they know.
Yeah, it does.
That makes sense. It's a lot more interactive.
No, definitely. And when I publish this podcast, I'm going to make sure I include your Twitter in the show notes. That way people can easily access it.
Perfect.
Well, Dr. Lenneke, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're a really busy guy and answering these questions.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And I'll give a shout out to all my students, because, you know, they're the ones that, you know, do a tremendous amount of this work. They do a tremendous amount of the writing. So, you know, all of my students are amazing. So, I just, you know, I always have to throw that out there, because, you know, it's one thing for me to come up here and say, oh yeah, you know, all of your work, it's our work. You know, it's mine in combination with all of my students and collaborators. So, I don't ever want to make it seem like I have come up with all these ideas on my own. You know, this is me, you know, while my students are, you know, at the lab working, you know, they work pretty much every single day. Most days, every day. So I couldn't ask for better students. So I'll give them a huge shout out as well. But it was a pleasure being on. I really appreciate you having me on.